Wow, okay. Dan, do you know how it goes forward? Oh, click, okay. Oh, and I should have said they reinforce in all the emails, but I forgot. As the moderator, I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. And now I'm going to move into my presentation, but I can't figure out how to go back. Oh, there we go. And my presentation is entitled Safety and Effectiveness of Oral Contraceptives, Making the Case for an OTC Switch. And see if I can get this to work. Okay. And as a presenter, we're asked to start off. I have no conflicts of interest to disclose. So I'm going to start just to give us a bit of background by talking about a few of the reasons the working group and those of us who participate in the working group on moving oral contraceptives over the counter are interested in thinking about an OTC switch, as we call it for short, for oral contraceptives. And I'm sure much of this information is known and familiar to all of you in the audience, but just to remind ourselves, in the U.S. there are 43 million women at risk of unintended pregnancy, and that means that they are not known to be infertile and are not pregnant and not trying to get pregnant. And of these, 11% of them are sexually active but not contracepting, and that number has been increasing, has increased since 1995. 49% of pregnancies in the United States are unintended, and 31% of women in the U.S. who are using a contraceptive method use oral contraceptives, and that's the most popular method. And again, something I'm sure that's very familiar to all of you, but just to remind ourselves, oral contraceptives are very effective methods, particularly when they are used consistently and correctly. The perfect use failure rate is 0.3%. The typical use failure rate is higher. This takes account of things like missed pills, interactions with antibiotics, things like that. That failure rate is about 8%, still a very effective method. And continuation is good. In the U.S., about 68% of women who start OCs will be using them 1 year later. So on this slide, we're taking a look in more detail about that figure I mentioned about the 11% of women who are at risk of pregnancy but not using a contraceptive method. And here you can see that the top bar is that 11%, and there are a number of differences among women. Women who have higher education are less likely to not be using a method, and women who are have lower incomes are less likely to be using a method. And we also see disparities by race and ethnicity. And we put this slide up here just to mention that clearly one of the major issues around this 11% of people is access to care and ensuring that people have access to the method. And so one major interest of to move oral contraceptives over the counter is to increase access. And this is just an illustration of the data I mentioned to start, that we are actually seeing increases in non-use of contraception, and these are particularly more dramatic when you look at lower-income women. And again, thinking about what's been happening over the between particularly 1995 and 2002 and the flat funding of Title X and the sort of real actual decrease in federal funding for contraceptive supplies and access, I think that's at least part of what's going on here, why we're seeing people not, an increase in people not using a method. There's also some information directly from women themselves about their experience accessing contraception that tells us a bit more about how an OTC switch might be helpful. This is data from the Pharmacy Access Partnership. As you can see on the top, they did a national phone survey in 2004 of 811 women who are at risk of unintended pregnancy. And they were asked about some of the obstacles to that they currently faced in accessing a contraceptive method. 27% said they had to wait a long time to get an appointment. 23% mentioned the doctor's office hours were not convenient. The cost of doctor visits was too much, hard to get time off work or off school, that a doctor's visit takes a long time, and 12% of women did not want a pelvic exam. And it's important to note that many of these, if not all of these barriers, could hopefully be either mitigated or removed in an over-the-counter environment. There's more. Okay. In the Pharmacy Access Partnership Survey, they then looked more closely at women's intentions and what women reported that they would do if they could get their hormonal method directly from a pharmacist. And just to be clear, this is a slightly different scenario than over-the-counter. This they were particularly asking about interacting with your pharmacist, and the pharmacist would then have the authority or be able to prescribe, as opposed to being able to sort of just pull the pills off the shelf themselves. But 42% of women in their study reported that they would start to use a hormonal method if it was available directly from a pharmacist. So removing some of the doctor prescription barriers, some of the inconvenience and other issues around having to go to a doctor for a prescription. And support for pharmacy access was high. 63% of all women not using contraception in that survey reported they liked the idea of accessing a hormonal method directly from a pharmacist. And support was actually higher among women who either did not have insurance or had low income. And again, the ever users of hormonal contraception in their survey, almost 30% of them reported that they had problems in the past getting their prescription or accessing supplies of oral contraceptives. And again, just highlighting how the current environment can make it difficult for women to get their pills. Before I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the more detailed safety data on OCs, but before I do that, I just wanted to remind us as a group what criteria the FDA uses when it considers moving a drug from prescription status to over-the-counter status. And here are the major criteria. The benefits outweigh the risks for most women. The potential for misuse or abuse of the drug is low. The person using that medication can recognize their need for the drug. The directions for use are straightforward. And the person using the drug could appropriately screen themselves to if they were not eligible for some reason or had a contraindication. And you see we've written these out here in the ways that you would think about them for oral contraceptives. So I think throughout our presentations today, it's going to be interesting to keep these in the back of your mind about the types of things we would want to know about oral contraceptives to make the case to the FDA that moving them over the counter would make sense. So now getting a little bit into some of the safety issues. Here are some of the major contraindications to oral contraception use. And as a background piece to this, many of you in the audience may know that many people cite safety as their major concern about the concept of moving oral contraceptives over the counter. And in fact, even in a prescription environment, we hear in many contexts concerns about the safety of oral contraceptives and other hormonal methods. But oral contraceptives are, particularly compared to other drugs, extremely safe, and they are one of the best studied medicines that's available on the market today. But in the presence of some conditions, oral contraceptive use can lead to sometimes serious adverse events. And here you see some of the main, as I mentioned, some of the main contraindications: hypertension, smoking, history of cardiovascular disease, migraine, and diabetes. And these all relate to a potential increased risk in cardiovascular disease, stroke, or myocardial infarction for women who have these conditions and use oral contraceptives. There are other more detailed contraindications. If you've ever looked at an oral contraceptive pill label, you will see there are many of them in very fine print. They're much more rare. And so these are really the main ones we would be talking about for most women, at least in the United States. These stars just indicate that some of the contraindications that are on the label and that are in provision guidelines are, in fact, not necessarily supported by detailed evidence in the literature and are extrapolated from other things. So it's important to keep that in mind as you look at the contraindications. And one important note here is just to see that for virtually all of these, except for hypertension, the way that a clinician is going to find out if a woman has a contraindication is to ask her about it. And you'll hear more about self-screening and women's report of their contraindications in the next talk. So these contraindications, and in fact, a lot of the information in the oral contraceptive labeling and guidelines does not reflect necessarily what we know to be the best clinical evidence that's available about oral contraceptives. For example, breastfeeding is listed as a contraindication in the label, and yet this is based on some not very good data that suggests that maybe breast milk flow would be lower if women started a combined method. But in fact, the data is not very convincing at all. And that's just one example of a number of different ways that the label doesn't reflect what we know from current research. The labeling also does not reflect newer data on provision innovations and provision innovations that have been tested to try and improve access and acceptability of hormonal methods. For example, it's been shown that there's no safety or health reason to require women to have a pelvic exam or a pap smear to get their oral contraceptives. And it's been shown that quick start, which means starting a hormonal method at any point in your menstrual cycle, is as effective and acceptable as next period start, which is still in much of the labeling of methods, asking women to wait until after they've had their next menstruation before you allow them to start the method. And in addition, it's important, I think, to remember that the prescription requirement itself can also lead women and people in general to think that oral contraceptives are not safe, that the idea that you need a physician intervention or a physician visit in order to know if you're eligible leads people to believe that they're probably much more dangerous, or leads people to think they're much more dangerous than they actually are. But this, I would say, is the main slide, the most important message of this talk about the safety of oral contraceptives. And this is a beautiful graph that I have borrowed from Schwingel et al., and so I can't take credit for making it look so nice. But it's particularly useful because it puts the safety of oral contraceptives in the context of other conditions, the most important of which is pregnancy. So, okay, let's see if I can use this. Here we go. So here, this line, these yellow bars, these are the risks of cardiovascular disease mortality per 100,000 women for women who carry a pregnancy to term. And as you can see from the bars around them, for women who are under age 35, oh, now it's gone away. Oh, here we go. For women who are under age 35, so that's everyone from where I'm moving this pointer over to this side, to the left. For all of those women, there are lower rates of cardiovascular disease mortality in all these categories. In all these categories, cardiovascular disease mortality is lower than among women who carry a pregnancy to term. So that means that for women who smoke, for women who use oral contraceptives, and for women who smoke and use oral contraceptives at the same time, which is the riskiest combination, they all have lower cardiovascular disease mortality than women who carry a pregnancy to term. And of course, when you're thinking about access to oral contraceptives, in many ways, that's the alternative. Because for some women who don't have access, what that may mean is put them at higher risk of unintended pregnancy. And so that's, I think, perhaps the most important message from my talk about safety. For women over 35 in this slide, you can see that taking oral contraceptives is, again, less risky than carrying a pregnancy to term. And among the oldest women, the risk from smoking alone is about twice that from taking OCs alone. So again, just to put into context some of the things as we're thinking about recommendations we might make in the context within which we consider an over-the-counter switch. there's a lot more I could say about this, but I'm going to just move on so that we can, I can be close to time. I mean, one of the other interesting things to know about contraindications is, you know, what are the prevalence of these contraindications among women who are users, likely users of oral contraceptives. And the vast majority of women, particularly women under 35, 95% of them, based on an analysis of some NHANES data, have no contraindications. And you can see that the rates of hypertension, diabetes, and relevant cancers that are contraindications in this population in particular are very low. In women age 35 and older, the rates are somewhat higher, but again, they are reasonably low in all cases, and in all cases, except for the hypertension one, which we'll talk about a little bit more in detail later, these are conditions which women themselves know whether or not they have them or would be contraindicated. The severe headache ones here, interesting. I mean, migraine with aura is a contraindication to oral contraceptive use. These numbers look very high, 30% in both groups. But the question asked here was about whether someone had had a severe headache in the last 3 months. And so I think it's important to take these with a grain of salt. This probably is not the equivalent of what we're talking about for the contraindication, but we couldn't find any data that specifically looked at migraine with aura among potential users of OCs. And again, the flip side of this is, well, what is going on in the prescription environment? And in fact, 94% of women who are currently using OCs report no contraindications to use. But some women who are currently using OCs do report contraindications, and this again, is data from the NHANES survey, which could be for a number of reasons. One, it could have been that women didn't remember or didn't tell their provider about a contraindication. Two, it may be that they decided with the provider that despite the contraindication, it was still the benefits outweighed the risks for them to use oral contraceptives. Or three, they may have developed the contraindication after they originally started using oral contraceptives. So there are a number of reasons why this might be the case, but certainly the prescription environment does not stop all women who have contraindications from using oral contraceptives. And although I don't have time, obviously, to go into some of all of the safety issues, I think it's really important to remember that there are also some significant health benefits of oral contraceptive use that are not reflected in the labeling and are really that are not being shared widely among current users or potential users of OCs. This paper came out in The Lancet this year, showed that women who used oral contraceptives for 5 years within the last 10 years reduced their rates of ovarian cancer by 30%, by almost 30%. And this is a very important finding, particularly because you all may know it's very difficult. There's no accurate screening test for ovarian cancer, and many women who get ovarian cancer present late in the disease. And so the editors of The Lancet, based on this information, actually called for more widespread over-the-counter access to oral contraceptives, in part as a cancer prevention strategy to reduce rates of ovarian cancer. So that is a very brief run through some of what I hope are some of the main safety issues, both safety and health issues to consider. I'm going to skip my next two slides because I think I need to go on. But just to say quickly that one of the additional concerns, obviously, is cost and what would happen in an OTC environment to the cost. It is true that in many cases, drugs or products that switch from prescription to over-the-counter do increase in cost, but the message of all of these two slides, and just to show you the second one, is that we need to also consider other costs that are involved, for example, getting to the physician. Under many insurance plans right now, women are limited to only getting one pack of pills per month, which means there's a lot of inconvenience and cost continually returning to get your pack of pills rather than being able to sort of buy them at your convenience and save time, money, childcare, all those kind of costs that women experience. So I want to acknowledge my colleagues and the steering committee and members of the Working Group on Oral Contraceptives Over the Counter. Thank you very much. And I am now going to turn it over. Let's see. Great.